This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Witch and Wizard, The Fire, written by James Patterson and Jill Dombowski, read by Elijah Wood and Spencer Locke.
Dedication for Jack, who started me down this long, twisted, magical road. You will be king one day, and you'll be a very good king. JP.
For Bobby Dombowski, who taught me the magic of words. And Mark Dombowski, who cheers louder than any football fan. JD.
Welcome to your worst nightmare. Or maybe one you can't even imagine. A world where everything has changed. There are no books, no movies, no music, no free speech. Everyone under 18 is distrusted. You and your family could be taken away and imprisoned at any time. Your very being is expendable, even unwanted. What world is this? Where could something like this have happened? That's hardly the point. The point is that it did happen. It's happening to us right now. And if you don't stop and pay attention, it could happen in your world next. You want a fairy tale, don't you? Well, I'm not sure I can give you that. You can find adventure here, that much is true. There's magic, too, and murder, and intrigue. And there is a man more wicked, more ruthless, than any monster or madman lurking in your grimmest childhood nightmares. But there are no heroes. I can't be that for you. Not anymore. Not after everything that's happened. It went like this. There was a great orator, smart and charismatic. Crowds came from every corner of the overworld, hypnotized by his promises. They called him the one who is the one for a reason. He was the one who would change the world. It wasn't until he took everything away that the people even knew what they'd had. First, we watched our books burn, the gray tendrils of smoke choking out our protests. Then our art and our music disappeared, and the rest of our freedoms weren't far behind. Red banners stretched up over the tallest buildings, and ash rained down with bombs. Prisons overflowed with children, and when they were released, they were no longer just kids, but dead-eyed warriors trained in torture. It was for the greater good, the one said. The New Order, he called it. The prophecies talk about two people who will alter the course of this history. A girl and a boy, a witch and a wizard. My sister and I, Wisty and Wit Allgood. It was as surprising to us as much as to anyone. Terrifying, even. We tried to be your heroes, tried to live up to that destiny. With our newfound powers, we offered hope. We joined the resistance movement and infiltrated the prisons. We protested the new order and advocated for peace. But after the last bombing, my sister and all of our freedom fighters were scattered like seeds in the wind, the entire resistance crumbling. Even our parents went up in smoke. Their cries still echo in my ears. So I had no one left. I thought I had nothing left to give. But then came the plague. It was my last chance to make a difference. I walked into homes that smelled of death and seethed with disease. I carried bleeding children into clinics and shelters. And in one of those clinics, I found my sister working as a nurse, helping as I had, hoping as I did for a better future. But then, Wisty got sick too. Now, the one who is the one's eyes, playful and cruel, looked down mockingly at me from the billboards. I'd thought we could fight him. I'd thought we could win. I guess I was wrong. You see, without both Wisty and me, there is no history, no future, no hope. And she's dying. So here we are. This is the end. This is no fairy tale, and there is no happily ever after. Our world is real, too real. It sounds like children shrieking in the darkness and soldiers' boots thundering through the streets. It smells of sewage and disease and defeat. It feels like the weight of my sister writhing in my arms. It tastes of blood. Book 1, Blood Holiday. Chapter 1. My lungs are bursting, and if she dies, I'll die. We're tearing through the cramped, dank streets of the capital, running for our lives from the New Order police and their trained wolves. My calves are burning, my shoulders ache, and my mind is numb from all that's happened. There is no more freedom, so there is no escape. I stumble through this strange, awful world we have inherited, past a mass of the sick who are shuddering from more than just the cold. A man collapses at my feet, and I have to wrestle my arm away from a woman holding a baby and pointing at me, shrieking, "The one has judged! He has judged you!" And then there's the blood. Mothers scratch at open pustules, and children cough into rags stained red. Half the poor in this city are dying from the blood plague, and my sister is one of them. Wistie's even paler than usual, and her slight frame is curled over my back, her thin arms wrapped around my neck. She's in agony. Her breath comes in gasps. She's murmuring about Mom and Dad, and it's ripping my heart right out of my chest. The street pulses with waves of vacant-eyed citizens scurrying to work. A guy in a suit shoulders me to the curb, and an old man who seems to recognize me slurs something about dark arts under his breath and hurls a glob of spit at my cheek. Everyone has been brainwashed or brutalized into conformity. I can hear the shrieks from the abused populace as the goons hammer through them just a block behind. They're gaining on us. I can picture the wolves straining against their chains, foam building on their jagged teeth as they yank our pursuers forward. All missing fur and rotting flesh, their Satan's guard dogs come to life. Something tells me that if, or when, the New Order police catch us, those animals aren't exactly going to go easy. There's got to be an open door or a shop to slip into, but all I can see are the imposing, blaringly red banners of propaganda plastering every building. We are literally surrounded by the New Order. Now they're right on us. The cop in the lead is a little zealot who looks like a ferret. His face is beet red under an official hat with the NO insignia on it. He's screaming my name and wielding a metal baton that looks like it would feel really awesome smashing across my shins. Or through my skull. No, I will not go out like this. We have the power. I think of Mom and Dad, of their faces as the smoke streak toward them. We will avenge them. I feel a rush of rebel inspiration as lines of a banned poem thunder in my head along with the soldier's boots. Rise like lions after slumber, an unvanquishable number. I put my head down, hike up Wistie, and surge forward through the plague-ridden crowds. I won't give up. Shake your chains to earth like dew. I break away from the crowd, seeing an opening at the end of the street. Which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few. We used to be many when the resistance was thriving. Their faces flash before me. Janine, Emmett, Sasha, Jamila, and Margot. Poor Margot. Our friends are long gone. Now it's just me. I burst through the mouth of the alley into a huge square. A mob of people gathers, looking at one another expectantly. Then a dozen 50-foot-tall high-definition screens light up, surrounding us and broadcasting the latest New Order news feed. With everyone distracted, it's the perfect time to find a way out of this death trap. But I can't tear my eyes away from this particular broadcast. It's a replay of footage from my parents' public execution. My head swims as Mom and Dad look down from all around us, trying to be brave as they face the hateful crowd. And as I watch the people I love the most in the world go up in smoke for the second time, I hear Wistie's hysterical, delirious ramblings. No! She flails in my arms, trying to reach out for them, just like she did that day. Help them, Wit! She shrieks. We've got to help them! She thinks she is watching our parents' actual execution again. Before I can soothe my sister, she's hacking, and I feel something hot and wet oozing down my neck and shoulders. I gag back my own bile, but the most horrific part of all is that the mess dripping down my sides is full of blood. She hasn't got much time left. Chapter 2. I've got to get Wisty somewhere safe. Like, now. We seem to have lost the club-wielding pigs behind the crowd for a few precious seconds, so I whirl around to find another alleyway, and nearly run smack into my own face. I stumble backward, chills running down my spine. And then I see them. 100 posters, or 1,000, on every pole and window. Wisty and me. Wisteria Rose Allgood, and Whitford P. Allgood. Witch and wizard. Highly dangerous criminals, wanted alive. Mostly dead acceptable. I whip around again, hyperventilating. I feel eyes on me everywhere. An old woman grins up at me with a mouthful of missing teeth. A couple of suits trot down the white marble steps of the Capitol building, their cigars pointed our way. There's a little girl standing off to the side, her wide gray eyes boring into me. She knows. They all know. Right on cue, the squad storms through the entrance to the square, their heads flicking around in search of us. And then, like something out of a horror movie, the zombie wolves start to howl. There's a small, partially bombed-out stone building down a side street that I can spot from here, and it looks promising. Or at least more promising than the jaws of the half-dead mutts. I slink toward it as inconspicuously as possible, and slip in through a side door. A gargantuan painting of the one who is the one greets me, his bald head and technicolor eyes bearing down, and a sign on the wall reads, "Confess your crimes to the new order, and you will be spared." The one already knows all. There are bullet shells on the floor. This could be really bad. But there's no one here. We're safe, for now. My shoulders and lower back muscles are screaming, so I finally slide my sister down to the floor. She looks like the image of death. I sit her up in my lap. "Come on, Wisty," I plead, wiping her face with my shirt. "Stay with me." Her red hair is matted with sweat, but her teeth are chattering. I hold her clammy hand, whisper the words of some of my surefire healing spells over her, and add every ounce of hope I have into the mix. Only, nothing works. How can my power be bone dry? I'm a wizard, but I can't even save my sister. She's my constant, my best friend. I can't just sit here and watch her get weaker, watch her eyes puff up as the blood leaks into them, watch her float in and out of consciousness until her world finally goes dark. I can't keep watching the people I care about most die. I already did that. Twice. I wince, thinking of Mom and Dad. If they'd only taught me a bit more about how to wield this power before... I can't finish the thought. It's not just a problem with my power, I'm sure of it. There's something in the air here in the Capitol, like the one poisoned it or something. And it's turning the New Order followers into empty, nodding pod people, and the poor potential dissenters into writhing, moaning blood plague victims. The survival rates haven't been high. "Why did you have to volunteer at that stupid plague camp and get sick, Wisty?" I whisper shout at her through angry tears. "We've seen what the one can do, and if he wants every single free thinker in the ghetto to get sick, then no amount of healing spells is going to make you immune." I need my sister, the often annoying know-it-all rebel leader, greatest threat to the New Order, unexpectedly rockin' musician, witch extraordinaire. I can't do this alone. No, I can't do this without her. She was the only one I had left in the world. My breath catches in my throat. I've already been thinking of Wisty in the past tense. I feel everything within me explode at once. I smash my hand into the painting of the one, but it's as if it's made of metal and my hand throbs in agony. "I wouldn't do that if I were you," a voice says from the door. I whip around to find a young soldier seemingly dressed in his daddy's too big uniform, pointing a gun at me from the entrance. I almost laugh. This is the twerp who's bringing us in? "Yeah, I kind of figure that out now. Thanks," I say, cradling my injured hand. I look behind him. No one seems to have followed him here. "On behalf of the New Order and in the name of the one who is the one," he looks up at the painting, reverently, I demand that you surrender your power and turn over the one who has the gift. He means Wisti. The one wants her fire. I take a couple of steps toward my sister protectively. The barrel of the gun follows, trained between my eyes. Freeze, wizard, his adolescent voice cracks. One more step, and I blow you from here to the next dimension. It's like he's been rehearsing his lines on action figures. I've been to the next dimension, actually, I quip. The Shadowland's not so bad. Even with my hurt hand, I could easily deck him, if I could just get a few steps closer. At my nonchalance, his expression changes to one of sour insolence. He evidently decides to up the ante. Or I could just kill her instead, he says, swinging the gun toward Wisti. They might even give me a medal. They wouldn't. They'd be furious that he destroyed the potential of so much power, and probably execute him on the spot. I don't say this, though. The eager way he's fingering the trigger has my attention. Hey, now, no need to overreact, I say, putting my hands up. Let's all just remain calm. I try to keep my voice even. Boy soldier, brainwashed. When the first kill still feels like a game, when it still seems as if the victim will sit up afterward and ask to play again. But Wisti won't. Silence hangs thick between us as the kid debates between his conscience and his pride. I already know which will win, which always wins. His eyes narrow in the mark, his finger tightening. I start to sweat, ready to leap in front of my sister. But before I get that far, his eyes flutter, and he crumples to the ground. I let out a long breath. What just happened? Did my power suddenly flare up and go rogue? Did I have a perfectly targeted spasm of some kind? No. Something had nailed him in the back of the head. I spot an object rolling to a stop nearby. A snow globe? In the entryway behind him is that same big-eyed, grim-faced little girl who was watching me in the square. She looks fierce, her tiny mouth twisting in annoyance. The expression kind of reminds me of Wisti at the height of her frustration with me. The girl is standing outside the door, beckoning me into the alleyway. You just gonna gawk at me, wizard boy? I've got more where that came from, if you need a little nap. Chapter 3. You have two choices, the pint-sized vigilante professes. I look at her warily. There's no telling if she's really on my side. They've used kids to get to us before, and there are almost no rebels left in the capital. There's a reward for our capture, no doubt. Maybe she's got dark motives. She's filthy and bone thin, but she's got this strangely confident expression. And weirder, she's wearing antlers. Then it sinks in, the holiday. In my panic, I must have missed the details. Though celebrating the holiday is forbidden under pain of death, I now see hints of it everywhere as I glance out the window. Ribbons clipped to New Order flags, candles winking from windowsills, and the kind of ice sculptures that Wisti and Mom went nuts for. Only these are shimmering tributes to the One. You have two choices, the little girl repeats impatiently. And they are your choices, and yours alone. She's got her hands on her hips, her round, silvery eyes glaring out of her tiny face. She's probably around 7 or 8, but her eyes look way older, like those of the wizened elves Wisti and I used to read about in the Necklace King series, back when we got a kick out of fantasy books and didn't know we actually had magical powers. You can either come with me or let the red-haired girl die. It's no big thing for me, the little fountain of goodwill says, like death is something she's intimately familiar with, even bored by. You should dump her and save yourself. She eyes Wisti and frowns. That's what I'd do. Chapter 4. Pearl Marie Niederman, she huffs, making no effort to shake hands. My place isn't far. Against my better judgment, I follow the kid out behind the building and duck into an alley roped off with a sign that reads, Quarantine Zone. Still, dragging my dying sister back through the N.O. squatty-packed Capitol Square doesn't exactly seem like a better option. Pearl Marie is small but lightning quick, even though she's lugging a large bag. With Wisty in my arms, I have trouble keeping up as the little girl slips under fences and around streetcarts, holiday antlers bobbing. There are no people in the street except for blood plague sufferers, and more than one suspicious face slams a door and draws the blinds as we pass. Maybe I'd take it as an insult if I weren't still dripping with Wisty's vomit. After less than half a mile, the police are on our trail again, smashing their clubs through abandoned food stands and hurling insults at our backs. But the plague victims are constantly underfoot and crave vengeance. I turn to see a herd of the sick descend on a couple of soldiers, the men's howls muffled as they're pulled down into a pit. Pigeons scare up as fear-stricken shrieks echo down the alley, and soon we no longer hear the crush of boots on pavement. Many of the policemen are turning back, or are now infected. The maze of turns is dizzying, and Wisty's getting heavier and heavier. But even with the cops off our tail for the moment, Pearl jets along, seemingly running into circles like a greyhound that just can't stop chasing a rabbit. Just as I'm about to protest and ditch the kid, she wheels around and says, "Here." What she's pointing at looks like a demolished pile of rubble. I hate to break it to you, Pearl Marie, but it kind of looks like the New Order bomb strikes got to your home first. The kid sighs like I've totally disappointed her. "You're not really a wizard, are you? It's over here, stupid." I follow her and maneuver Wisty through the narrow side entrance into a one-room, dismal basement apartment. I have to duck to get through the doorway. There's almost no light, and it smells of mothballs and disinfectant. Pearl Marie lowers her sack and motions to our surroundings. "You can just drop the witch anywhere, really," she says, like my sister is a coat or a pair of shoes. "Where is everyone else?" I note the scraps of blankets and bedding covering the floor. It's clear that a lot of people have been living here for a while. Pearl laughs ruefully. "Oh, they're all out doing things that are actually important. You know, scavenging for necessities, things to save our family, not whispering hocus-pocus or waving their fingers around like lightning is going to zap out of them." I narrow my eyes. I realize I'm not in top form at the moment, but who is this girl? "Look, we can leave right now." "No, stay." Her face softens. "Everyone will be home soon, and I have something to show you, what I've been collecting all day. They gave me the biggest job of anyone," she beams. I'm expecting food, or blankets, or beans she might have lifted from the purse of some New Order drone to buy medisalves or to bribe soldiers with. But Pearl opens the sack so reverently that for a second, I think it must be something really important, even more than money. Like a baby or a puppy or something. It's holiday decorations? Make that broken holiday decorations. Of course, now the snow globe makes sense, and the antlers. "Aren't they beautiful?" Pearl whispers in awe. I nod. I have to admit, they kind of are beautiful, all shimmering, shattered glass and colorful broken lights. Still, I'm getting antsy. The decorations are nice and all, but this kid is a piece of work. My sister is dying here. Wisty's tossing on the floor, ripping at the blankets in anguish, and Pearl keeps staring intently at the broken lights, as if they hold secret powers. Finally, she notices my agitation and sets the sack aside carefully. Then she fishes out some moldy-looking rags and wets them from one of the buckets set up to catch ceiling leaks. Pearl puts a compress on my sister's forehead. It's all I can do to keep it together when Wisty moans. "Mama, just let me die. Please, just let me die." "Oh, you will," whispers Pearl Marie. "You will." Chapter 5. I'm about to tell off Pearl Marie for her cruel pronouncement when the door slams open. Instinctively, I tense up in an offensive position. But this posse isn't N.O. It's family. I can hardly blink before Pearl disappears in a sea of embracing bodies, and a big hand grasps my shoulder and spins me around. An older gray-haired man looks me up and down and shakes his head. "Mama May isn't going to like this one bit," he warns, his face serious, but I can see that his eyes are more amused than angry. Before I can ask who Mama May is, he spots Wisty in the corner, blood all over the front of her shirt, and winces. "That your girl? In bad shape, isn't she?" "My sister," I nod, not sure if I can say anything else without totally losing it in front of this man. "She's a trooper." There's a long, silent moment between us that seems to acknowledge just how screwed Wistie really is. Too long, too silent. I notice a group of women across the room with the same dark, lank hair as Pearl. They're all giving me sidelong looks and whispering. "They hate us," I think. "They're all just waiting for Wistie to die so they can go back to feeling at least a little bit safer." I'm almost starting to resent this man, but then he grabs my hand in the strongest handshake I've ever felt and looks at me intensely. "I'm Hewitt," he says. "If you need anything, don't hesitate to ask." He glances at the women staring at us and chuckles. "Don't mind them. They're just paranoid. Mama May will set it right." Mama May, I soon learn, is Pearl Marie's mom. The moment she enters the room, it gets warmer. She takes up space, literally. Her big girth is a sharp contrast to the rest of her spaghetti-legged family. But she's also got presence. Her full, hearty laugh could almost make me believe we're not orphaned in a world controlled by a psychopath with a god complex. It could almost make me believe we're home. But Mama May takes one look at Wistie and me, and her face blanches, and she frowns so deeply, she looks like a big, disapproving grouper. "Pearl, honey, come here. I'm not so sure this is the best idea." Mama May cocks an eyebrow in Wistie's direction. "We've lost so many to the blood plague already, and with them being wanted and all." Pearl puts on a face of such innocent longing it almost looks like a mask. It's a face only a youngest child can master. "Mama, please let them stay. If we were going to get the plague, we'd all have it by now. And look at her. She'll probably die in a few minutes anyway." I notice she brushes right over the fact that we're wanted fugitives. Pearl's hands are on her hips, and her big eyes are pleading. Even against Mama May, she's certainly got clout. And even before she says, "It's the holiday. We have to do the right thing," I know Mama will cave. Half an hour later, despite Mama May's ruling in our favor, most of Pearl's dozen or so family members are still glaring at me with nervous hostility. I mean, they look like every other family that has gone through hardship under the NO. They have deep creases in their faces from watching their children carted off to disciplinary prisons, bruises under their eyes from sleepless nights, expecting raids. And with no more music, art, or expression in the world, their muscles don't remember how to smile. But there's something else, too. They look straight up terrified. It's the eyes. That silvery gray is mesmerizing and demands accountability. And I can't look away. They're haunted. I pull Pearl off to the side and gesture at the onlookers. "Hey, what's going on?" I ask. "What's everyone afraid of? I mean, I realize we're wanted criminals, but they know nobody knows we're here, right?" She glares back at me fiercely. "What do you mean, what's everyone afraid of? What is everybody in the entire overworld afraid of? It's not about you being on the run. It's because you've been involved with him." "You mean the one? But why would he..." I want to say that surely the Niedermans are small potatoes to the new order. They're not resistance anyway. "Shh," she hisses, eyes wild. "We don't say that name in this house." She grips my arm and drags me over to her corner, even farther away from the others. But there's an audible increase in whispering. "We are almost all that's left," Pearl says gravely. I look at her, not understanding, and she gestures impatiently around the room at the candles, the figures, the signs of their devout religion. "The only ones who still believe in the holiday and everything it stands for, who still keep the faith," she says, "and his spies are everywhere." "But there must be other people who still practice," I press, thinking of the illegal holiday decorations present in the square, the obvious signs that there are other religious families still holding on. She shakes her head. "Everyone just believes in him now. In the beginning, we gathered in one of the halls. We thought we'd be safe there, that they'd respect the holiness of the place. Instead, it just made us a giant target. He sent his henchmen to do his dirty work." Pearl looks mesmerized, as if she's watching the events unfold in a movie. One of them had learned some of his evil magic. He wanted to put his hands on our heads. Some of the kids went right up to him, because it was like being blessed, like we were used to at the hall. I stayed behind, but not my brother, not Zig. Ziggy was smart, but he had more faith than any of us. Pearl smiles faintly, remembering, but then her expression darkens. And the evil man? He wouldn't stop smiling. Put his hand on Ziggy's forehead. Ziggy was smiling too. And then Ziggy's face, it started... She swallows, her eyes unfocused. Melting. Just melting off. She takes a breath. I kept screaming for Ziggy, but then someone grabbed me. And then we were running. That's all I remember. I'm almost too horrified to speak. Pearl is staring straight ahead, her mouth a thin line. But you're here now, I say. You're safe. She laughs, and it's cold, harsh. Yeah, safe. I look around at the frightened faces, the spooked eyes, and I finally get it. I'm one of the Dark Ones, with this terrific power I possess. My magic makes me like him, regardless of how I use it. Hewitt approaches us and looks at Pearl's angry little face. He raises an eyebrow at me, but lets it go. Here, he hands me a sorry-looking candle made of some kind of fat. We light these every night, for the dead. We're about to begin. I want to ask Pearl more questions, about Ziggy, and above all about the horrifying smiling man who melts children's faces. But she's already standing up to join her family in a big circle. And it's clear from that determined expression setting her lips in a tight little knot that that's the last she's ever going to say about poor Ziggy Niederman.
Chapter 6. It's like I'm swimming, my long red hair swirling around me. I'm swimming, only my goggles are foggy and my air tank has just run out of oxygen. My lungs are burning so much I think for a second that I might be flaming out and can actually feel it for the first time. The girl who can set herself on fire. Some gift. There seems to be a ton of people surrounding me, and none of them look like my brother. Where is Wit? I vaguely remember him carrying me, but what's happened since then? Is he sick? Is he being tortured somewhere by my skeletal captors? Two kids stand over me, prodding my arm with a stick. The bigger one, a freckle-faced show-off with a chipped tooth, is answering a question the other has asked. She's the red-haired witch, dummy. Not very good at it, is she? I focus through the pain and summon all my energy to fix the little braggart with a long, withering look. To my utter satisfaction, the kids scamper away in horror. She'll change us into rodents, Freckles yells. My reputation has preceded me. Somehow, it feels like an overwhelming relief that I can still strike fear into the hearts of children. Exhausted, I collapse back into the cushion of sleep. The next time I open my eyes, it's dark, and there are candles everywhere. Everyone in the room looks shell-shocked, like they've just received the worst news. My heart starts to race until I see my brother. He's across the room, standing with some grubby-looking little girl, and I feel such a sense of relief I almost pass out again. I wish I could get his attention, but I don't have the strength to move. An older man with a weathered face and a braid running down his back is leading some kind of vigil. These people, whoever they are, have lost someone. My heart aches for them. I know what loss feels like, too. Believe me. Let's not let them take everything from us yet, though. The weathered man looks from face to face, eyes fierce. Let's sing for family. Let's sing for hope. The crowd of filthy, gaunt survivors all hold hands, and there's barely enough space in this tiny basement room to fit them all. The whole place is radiant with candlelight, and the broken glass dangling from the ceiling shimmers. Then the singing starts up. It's low at first, and then, as more and more voices join in, the volume builds, like the vibrations of a bell or the mournful echo when you trace a finger along the lip of a glass. You feel it inside you. It's so beautiful, you almost have to turn away. When I realize what they are singing, it's like an arrow to my chest. Silent, silent. Even buried under all this grief, I can see Dad's expressive face mouthing the words over our heads on holiday eve. Hear Mom's sweet voice dancing along the verses. A sob catches in my throat as I hum along to the familiar melody, tears streaming down my cheeks. I lock eyes with Wit across the room. He's looking at me like his heart is breaking, like he's saying goodbye. To me. I shake my head. No, no. The candles are blurring again. I'm drowning in darkness. Silent, silent. But I'm not ready to go. Not yet.
Chapter 7. I awake, disoriented, in cold, damp darkness, my body aching, my sister nowhere in sight. There are shadowy figures all around me, but I can't make them out. Something jabs me in the ribs, and I flip onto my feet, muscles tensed, ready to tear it to shreds. In the millisecond before I move to strike, there's a hyena-like laugh, high and mocking. Ooh, a familiar young voice teases. Someone is a little bit jumpy this morning. Come on, whiz boy, let's get going. I make out Pearl Marie's mop of ratty hair in the darkness, and yesterday comes flooding back to me. I must have passed out in a pile of rags. Go? Go where? It's still dark out, I groan. Between being a fugitive on the run from the most powerful being in the universe, re-watching our parents' execution, and carrying my dying sister on my back through a maze of plague victims and trained wolves, I've been put through the ringer, physically and emotionally. I could sleep until next holiday season. It's 1:30, quit your whining o'clock. Pearl Marie is already crouched down, digging through the rags. You're fit to work, ain't you? The tiny drill sergeant starts lobbing bedding at my head. Well, yeah, but... A moth-eaten sweater soars through the air. Gotta... Warp sun hat to the gut. Pull your weight, like everybody else. Find a disguise. I duck as a shredded blanket makes a beeline for my nose. Pearl stands up, hands on her hips. Everyone knows your stupid face. What about Wisty? I protest. I can't just leave her. No prob, Pearl shrugs. Mama May told me to stick close to the house and look after her. I soften a bit at the mention of Mama May, remembering how much the Niedermans are risking by taking us in. How dearly they'll pay should they be found out. I owe them this. I reluctantly start climbing into the crusty clothing. After a minute, I peek out from under my disguise of toga-like moldy blanket, topped with a half-unraveled scarf as a face mask, topped with a large sun hat. Does it still look like me? Big muscles? Small brain? Yep, I can definitely still tell it's you under there, Pearl frowns. I sigh in frustration. It used to be so easy before. I could just morph a bit, take the form of an old man, a bird, almost anything I'd need to be. Wait a minute. Something is different. Pearl's looking at me in wonder, and I feel things shifting. The shape of my nose, the length of my hair. And are those dimples I feel? Pearl holds up a piece of holiday glass so I can see my reflection. I'm stunned. After days of feeling my power slipping away from me, I can't believe it freaking worked. Who's got the mojo? Wizard's got the mojo. Meanwhile, Pearl's doubled over with laughter. Brandon Michael Hatfield? She snorts. Are you serious? What? I reply, incredulous. You know him? Brandon Michael Hatfield, Pearl's voice goes up a full octave. Of course I know him, she shrieks. He was the biggest dreamboat in the former Freeland. I just didn't realize you had the mind of a preteen girl. Celebrities have mostly been wiped out in the NO regime for representing idols other than the one. So what's the harm in making use of likenesses of long-gone pop stars? Besides, I've been the poster boy for public scorn long enough. Maybe I wouldn't mind having a face everyone likes for a change. So sue me. My girlfriend used to be into his music, I say, shrugging, pretending that the mention of Celia doesn't still hurt somewhere deep inside. Pearl nods skeptically. Hey, it's actually pretty tough to just come up with a new identity out of thin air. Sometimes you have to, you know, borrow one. Brendan What's-His-Face seemed like as good an option as anyone else. Brandon Michael Hatfield, she corrects, as if I've committed sacrilege. Got it, I roll my eyes. Anyway, it works, doesn't it? Pearl nods, still giggling, then hustles me toward the door. You better get going. But my sister. I glimpse Wistie's frail body across the room, her red hair matted with fever. If anything, she looks worse today. I'll tend to her for you. I'll talk to her and dab at her forehead. Trust me, I'll look after her. Pearl pats my hand and peers up at me with her big silver eyes, all scout's honor. I start to smile gratefully, but then Pearl finishes. At least until she dies. Chapter 8. I'm tearing through the streets, madly searching for an escape from this sad and tragic world. And it does seem mad that I'm trying to get to a place where the dead still walk. To the underworld, to the Shadowland, to Celia, the love of my life, trapped among the lost ones. I can't get Pearl's words, until she dies, out of my head. If I could just get back to Celia, I know she could tell me what to do. She'd been brutally murdered by the New Order, but she sometimes still came to visit me, as a spirit. And she had helped Wistie and me so many times before. She'd know what to say, wouldn't she? I don't care. I need her now, no matter what. Her sweet smell, her comforting arms, her voice whispering encouragement. I can't be alone now. Like I'd done so many times before, I head for a concrete wall at the end of an alleyway and smash my shoulder into it at full force, hoping for some vulnerability I can't see, a bend in the fabric of this dimension, giving way to the next. We'd used this pathway before, in the days when it seemed portals to the Shadowland were everywhere. But the One's influence is growing, and many portals have disappeared or have been blocked. Like this one. I'm met with only a bright flash of pain, and I crumple to the ground, utterly defeated, yearning for Celia, for my parents, for the kids who gave their lives for the resistance. I've lost nearly everything, and now I'm going to lose my sister, too. The words lap at my ears like an echo in a seashell. Until she dies. No, not yet. I dragged myself out of the garbage on the street. I will not let my sister die. Chapter 9. I pull myself up, new energy coursing through me. I'm thinking of the resistance fighters, of Janine and Margot and Emmett, kids who had lost everything, but who would never give up on one another, and never gave up on us. Kids who are long gone now, but whose determination I can still feel. I'm also thinking of Byron, whom Wistie zapped into a weasel on more than one occasion. As screwed up as a lot of his theories were, Byron seemed to be right about one thing. When our power went through him, it became stronger, even though he didn't possess any magic on his own. We'd tested that on other kids, too, and it had seemed to work. So maybe, just maybe, it could work now. I sprint back to the Niedermann's bombed-out apartment building, taking the basement stairs two at a time, and then burst into the small room searching for Pearl. She's nowhere to be found. What was it she said? I'll look after her. Trust me. I'm not sure I know the meaning of that word anymore. I crouch down by Wistie. She's still feverish and barely conscious, and her face is filthy. Don't give up on me yet, Wistie. I've got a plan. Just hang in there. I start to wipe my sister's face with a dirty cloth when the door opens and the little ragamuffin saunters in. Pearl sees my angry expression and shrugs. I got hungry and figured the witch wouldn't miss me, she says, cheerfully enough. Shouldn't be long now, anyway. The mess she coughed up earlier was some kind of gross black sludge. Before I know what I'm doing, I bat the scraps of food Pearl's holding to the floor and tug the little girl across the room toward my sister. Hey, she protests. It's not my fault, she's... You're not going to watch over Wistie until she dies. You're going to help me make her better, I tell her, voice as hard as iron. Right now. Chapter 10. On the cement floor in the drab basement apartment, Wistie struggles in the grubby linens, her breath coming in quick, jagged gasps. Sweat stands out on my sister's forehead, but her teeth chatter behind her papery lips. This has to work. Pearl slouches next to me, feigning boredom, but I'm gripping one of her hands and one of Wistie's with frenzied determination. Wistie coughs violently, and red drops of blood appear on the corners of her mouth. I lick my lips and try to swallow my panic. I have to work fast. We're losing her. I let go of Pearl and start to riffle through my journal for a spell, but Pearl snatches the book away with nimble fingers practiced in theft. Poems? The kid looks genuinely appalled. Give it. Now, I manage. It's taking a massive effort not to yell at her. Fine, she says, chucking the journal at my head. I'll just be over here, choking on my own vomit. That's what my dying sister is actually doing right now, thanks to your lack of cooperation. I heave a frustrated sigh. I lean over to pull Wistie's fire-red hair away from her clammy cheeks. Listen, Wist, you're not done living. Not by a long shot, I say quietly. You're not done rocking the music, bursting into flames like a badass, or mouthing off when I'm trying to give you advice. And this is the best advice your big brother is ever going to give you. I start to choke up, but force this last part out anyway, because I need my sister to hear it. You're not allowed to die yet, okay? It's definitely not in your best interest. Wistie doesn't move, and her breathing stays shallow. But Pearl's face softens, and she gets this big-eyed sympathetic look, like she might actually start crying too. I have something to say. Pearl awkwardly puts a hand on Wistie's shoulder, looking kind of embarrassed. I'm staring, not sure what to make of this, and she shoots me an annoyed look. Close your eyes, Wit. It's like a prayer or whatever. I shut my eyes obediently and hear her settle in beside me. I expect her to make some snide remark, but when she speaks, her voice is sad and sincere. Wit seems to care about you a whole lot, Pearl starts. I had a brother, too, who I cared about, and he used to keep an eye out for me, too. She's quiet for a moment. But he's gone now, and... Her voice quivers, and my heart lurches in my chest. And it was just the worst thing that's ever happened to me, so I know how he feels. Pearl pauses for a moment, as if deciding whether or not to go on. So just wake up already. Amen. I open my eyes, but Wistie's pale face is unmoving. Pearl grips my hand tightly, as if it had been her idea all along. Okay, wizard, she says gently. Now do your sappy poetry thing. I flip to a fresh page in my journal, and Murray Robinson's words unfold on the page before me. Though death but seldom turns aside from those he means to take, he would not yet our hearts divide for love and pity's sake. I shut my eyes tightly, and a shudder goes through me as I imagine the blurred, skeletal image of death pointing a spindly finger at Wistie, then turning away in defeat. He looks more like the one, actually. The anger builds within me until I'm shaking with all of the rage, pain, and frustration that comes from losing everything you love in the world. I say the poem over and over, my voice forceful and sure, and I hear Pearl chanting beside me too, her words warped by tears for Ziggy and the others whom death didn't turn away from. Energy surges through us into Wistie's frail body, and the single light bulb in the room flickers and shatters. My fingers burn with the spark of raw healing power. When the surge subsides, I peek at Wistie tentatively. I hold my breath, waiting to see the effects of my power, the color rushing into her cheeks, the familiar wry smile, her own magic emanating from her again. It has to have worked. I felt it. But she's not moving. I'm not even sure she's breathing. My pulse quickens. It's like she's already gone. Pearl is looking at me with big, nervous eyes. What if whatever I just did actually killed Wistie instead of saved her? And then, just as I'm ready to give up all hope, my sister's eyelids flutter open. I don't know what I was expecting. Lucidity, maybe? The magic hasn't made Wistie shiny and new again, or even totally well, but still, something has changed. Her eyes are dazed and feverish, burning into mine. And they're no longer ringed with red. Wistie! I shout, squeezing her way too roughly in a hug I can't stop. Hi, Wit, she chokes out. I'm okay. Tears slip down her cheeks, and I'm nearly sobbing with relief myself. With that small effort, Wistie passes out, but sheer, unfiltered joy floods through my system anyway. Somehow I know she's going to make it. I have the power to heal. This is what it's like to feel invincible.
Chapter 11. It's cold. So cold. I'm wrapped in blankets, but I'm as icy as a slab of beef hanging in a meat truck, chilled to the bone. The air tastes stale and recycled, but I can't even seem to lift my head to get a better look at this room. My vision is still a little blurry, but I'm suddenly aware of a figure next to me. I flinch, adrenaline rushing to my head as my body sends out the alert. Stranger! Dark, claustrophobic room. So many people want me dead. And where is my brother? I squint to focus my eyes. It's just a kid, I realize with relief. Her eyes are glued to me, a little smile on her grimy face. She has this weird beauty to her, and for a second I think she might be an angel. Then I see the glint of her knife. I try to lurch away from her, but my body won't obey. I feel paralyzed. I try to scream for help, but it comes out as a raspy, gurgling moan. The kid raises an amused eyebrow at me. I'm drugged, I think. She's drugged me and is about to carve me up. She moves toward me. Not knowing what else to do, I grip the covers with white-knuckle panic. A whimper escapes my lips. Relax, the girl says, her round gray eyes inches from my face. They're almost hypnotic. I'm still afraid, but I find myself automatically calming down. She sits cross-legged next to me and starts whittling at splinters of wood, the edge of the knife catching the low light of the single candle. I try to slow the blood thundering into my brain, and after a minute, she looks up. So, you're finally awake. People were placing bets that you'd be dead before sunrise, you know, she says matter-of-factly. I stare at this morbid little girl, not sure at all what to make of her. When Wit brought you in, he said he didn't know how much longer you'd last. But thanks to my help, you pulled through. How? I cough, then start again. How do you know my brother? My vocal cords are hoarse from disuse, and my voice comes out as more of a squeak than the threat I had intended. The big-eyed girl definitely doesn't appear threatened. She prattles on for what seems like forever, relating the list of everything she knows about me and my brother, like how our faces are plastered on every wall in the Capitol. But I can't seem to focus on her words. My heart constricts when she gets to the part about how our parents really are dead, but I'm too numb with cold to process much else. And her animated descriptions of deadly holiday ornaments, the poetry cure, and blood in the streets have my head spinning. I feel totally drained, like all the blood, energy, power, all the magic has been sucked right out of me. My hands are blue, is the only thing I keep thinking. If I could just get warm, work up a little magic, I could figure all of this out. Come here for a sec, I croak, interrupting the girl's tirade. I must sound utterly crazy, because the kid looks like there's absolutely no way she's getting any closer to me right now. Come on, want me to cough some blood your way? Just get over here and help me sit up, I prod. She reluctantly moves closer and tries to push up the rags behind me with the very tips of her fingers so she can avoid actually touching me. Whatever. If I'm gonna die, maybe I can at least warm up a bit first. I point a finger at the fireplace and catch my companion's skeptical look. I feel a twinge of anger, that familiar heat. That does it. A terrific fire crackles in the hearth, the 3-foot flames instantly warming up this damp room. Yes! I give a little uncontrollable squeak of victory. I may not be totally well, but my magic is coming back. The girl is evidently impressed. Whoa, she says with a twinge of awe that makes me way more proud than I should be for just a little fire. You really are a witch. And a scary witch, little girl, I bite back with a self-satisfied smirk, though I'm already collapsing into the rags, exhausted. Lucky for you, you didn't try to use that knife. The kid smiles. It's for cutting kindling. I wasn't gonna slice and dice you. Her fingers dance tauntingly over the handle of the weapon. It's the holiday, after all.
Chapter 12. I set out this morning, looking like Brandon Michael Hatfield again, still elated with the miracle of Wistie's recovery, and confident I could coax the rich, wasteful citizens of the New Order capital to throw me at least enough change to show the Niedermans my appreciation. But after 3 hours on a busy corner in the business district with only a meager handful of beans to show for it, I'm losing faith. It dawns on me that I haven't really seen much traffic in a while. This morning, herds of businessmen filed by, never mind that their vacant eyes looked right through me. But now, around lunchtime, when my little corner should be jumping, there's hardly anyone. Looking around, I notice that, save for the bored-looking lunch cart man, I am actually the only person on this block. A newspaper blows across the street like tumbleweed. There might as well be crickets, the road is so quiet. I stand up uneasy. This is the middle of the most frenzied, commercial place in the entire capital. Was I so swept up in self-pity I didn't notice things getting seriously weird around here? Then I hear a laugh down the block, and out of the corner of my eye, I notice 2 smartly dressed, cheery men slipping onto a side street. Curiosity piqued, I amble after them, leaving my cardboard sign in the dust. Rounding the corner of the alley, I'm totally unprepared for what I find. The smell hits me first. That smell. The nauseating stench of burning flesh and singed hair hangs in the air with a plume of black smoke. I cough, eyes watering. It's almost unbearable. At first, I don't understand where it's coming from. All I see is a large group of New Order citizens, mostly business people, impeccably dressed in sharp suits and mile-high heels, shouting gleefully, apparently enjoying some sort of rally during their lunch break. Then I see it. Her. The thing they're all standing around. In the center, tied to a post, is what looks like a large piece of meat, still smoking. The blackened, pulpy form at the stake doesn't register at first. My mind can't make the connection between a living, breathing human being and that. And then I see a tuft of hair clinging to the charred scalp, and my head starts spinning. Not a rally, a witch burning. My throat goes dry, and I feel paralyzed with horror. I'd heard the rumors, but I'd never imagined there could be people like this. I mean, the men and women who make up the group before me, the mob, just look so normal. Followers of the NO, yes. Richer than most, certainly. But still, they look like people you see every single day in the capital. People with families and jobs. People with some speck of compassion, surely. Until you see the emptiness in their eyes. Who knows who this doomed woman was, or if she even possessed any magic at all. The New Order, with its bold red banners blanketing the overworld, feeds on bloodlust. These are its children. Reality finally comes into sharp focus, and my heart races. I stumble forward, frothing with fury and purpose. Stop! I shriek, which feels incredibly insufficient. But what else is there to say? I'm too late, of course. Then an icy, deep-down fear wraps tightly around my heart and wrings out my breath. The screams I hear now don't belong to the woman. They're the sickening war cries of a mob gone mad. Because they're turning. The frenzied group is turning from the crisp remains of the poor soul strapped to the pillar. And they're turning on me. Chapter 13. Time stops, and every muscle in my body tenses as hundreds zero in on me like bloodthirsty piranhas, ready to pick me clean to the bone. "Aren't you Brandon Michael Hatfield?" a woman asks, awe creeping into her voice. I let out a long breath, nodding,